warming in the Gulf of Maine. Oceans all over the world are warming, but here in the Gulf of Maine, temperatures are changing even more dramatically than almost all others. Since 2004, the Gulf of Maine has been warming faster than 99% of the world's oceans. Why is this happening? And what are some of those impacts? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Those who work on the water are already seeing the effects of warming waters, from species that appear to be on the move to an increase in pathogens. Cities and towns are experiencing more flooding and storm surges, and the trend is expected to continue, if not accelerate. Today's show is part of Maine Calling's continuing focus on the effects of climate change in our region. Warming in the Gulf of Maine, next. But first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. It is a pretty shocking statistic. Out of all the world's oceans, the Gulf of Maine is warming at a rate that is 99% faster than anywhere else. We'll explore why this is happening here and what it means for the region's ecosystem and the people who work and live here. Joining me in the studio, Julie Rosenbach. She is Sustainability Director with the City of South Portland. Her background includes work in environmental policy. Meredith White is Director of Research for Mook Sea Farm, an oyster farm in Midcoast, Maine. She specializes in biological oceanography. And Andrew Pershing, he is Chief Scientific Officer at the Gulf of Maine Research Institute. As always, we want to hear from you. Have you noticed changes in the sea life or the surroundings of the Gulf of Maine? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you all for being here today. And Andrew, I'm going to start with you. For years, we've heard this fact now that the Gulf of Maine is warming more quickly than other oceans. First, can you talk about the scale? What are we talking about? How many degrees? And then second of all, why? Why? I understand why the oceans are warming generally, but why is the Gulf of Maine warming faster?
Great. So thanks for having me. It's great to be here. So over the last 30 years, the Gulf of Maine has warmed at a rate of about 0.11 degrees Fahrenheit per year, which doesn't sound like a lot, but when you magnify that over 30 years, you actually get a significant amount of change. And that amounts to that it's roughly more than three times faster than the global ocean average over that same time period. But as you look a little bit closer, a lot of that warming has happened much more recently, so mainly in the last 15 years. And over the last 15 years, we've warmed at about seven times the global ocean average, which puts us in this range where we're one of the fastest warming regions over that time period. And that leads us to the statistic that over that 15-year or 30-year timescale, that we've warmed faster than 99% of the global ocean.
So does that mean that, I was trying to do some quick math in my head, over the last 30 years, the temperature's gone up more than 3 degrees Fahrenheit, which someone might say 3 degrees isn't that much, but is that consistent throughout the year? And what is that, you know, what does a 3-degree difference mean?
Yeah, so it's not consistent throughout the year. We've actually had a lot more warming. A lot more of our warming now is coming during the summer and in the fall, which is really interesting because that's the time when we would normally hit our peak temperatures. So that means that for the animals and the other marine life out there, they're experiencing much higher temperatures than they ever have before. And a 3-degree Fahrenheit change, it's roughly equivalent to about the difference in temperature between, say, Portland and Boston or, you know, down in Cape Cod Bay. You're sort of talking about that scale of change.
Okay. I'm going to bring you into the conversation. Meredith, what do we know about how this 3-degree or around there temperature change affects aquaculture and other marine life?
Well, warming waters can cause changes in species distribution and be detrimental to cold water species and beneficial to warmer water species. And so we have seen increases in oyster growth rates in recent years. Last year was one of our best seed years ever. The small oysters that we put out at our lease site grew faster than in previous years. More wild oysters are coming into the populations because cultured oysters are spawning with these warmer temperatures. And so that can be beneficial for bringing oysters back into the wild populations. There are negative effects that come with this warming. So we're seeing increases in oyster pathogens, increases in human pathogens, and we need to be careful about this. And these threats are real. They're already happening. We have to take new and more strict and more expensive actions to ensure seafood safety as we harvest our oysters and bring them to market. And so these pathogens can affect oysters or potentially humans. There's a naturally occurring bacteria called Vibrio, which is increasing with warming waters. And so therefore, we have new stricter regulations on the time from when we harvest oysters until we get them into refrigeration to ensure that everyone can safely enjoy our products.
So the oysters are growing more quickly and more abundantly, but there's more risk that they could be unhealthy and make us unhealthy.
Yes, the oysters are growing faster, and that's wonderful for us. These bacteria are already present in the waters and their presence is increasing. We take extreme measures to make sure that the product we bring to market is safe, and the Department of Marine Resources carefully monitors this as well. So the oysters that we're bringing to our customers are safe to eat because we are investing more in the care that it takes us to get them to our customers.
So Andy and Meredith, I'll pose this both to you. There was recently a report that there are fewer baby lobsters in this region. Is that because of the temperature change?
So at kind of a macro scale, it's certainly possible. So we've seen in Rhode Island and southern New England, as the waters have warmed there, that lobster population has declined. And the thing that kind of the signal that foreshadowed the decline in that fishery was a decline in the baby lobsters that were settling. So we're seeing that now here in Maine, and Rick Wally at the University of Maine is the one who pulls a lot of that data together. And they've been seeing this now for several years. It's certainly consistent with the timing of warming, but I don't think we kind of have done that attribution. There are some other hypotheses out there that might explain that decline in addition to warming.
So the answer is maybe.
Possibly. It's certainly consistent. And that's, I think, a theme that we have as we look at a lot of the changes out in the ocean, is that there are some things that we can say definitely that's due to the warming. So when you see a mid-Atlantic species like black sea bass or like longfin squid showing up here, that's clearly related to the temperature. There are other things that are more subtle, like the decline of herring or like the decline of copepods, where it really looks more like the ecosystem is starting to go through this transformation into one that resembles a more temperate ecosystem.
Okay, I want to bring you, Julie, into this conversation. You're sustainability director for the city of South Portland. How long has the city of South Portland had a sustainability director, and how do you look at the warming ocean as something that will affect a city?
Sure, that's a great question. I have been in my job for 4 years now. It was a brand new position when I got into it, a brand new department, and one that hasn't been many cities and towns in Maine haven't had. Now there are, I'd say, 4 or 5 cities in Maine that have sustainability positions. It was brand new when I got into it. And I came from the college and university sector. And when I got into that sector in the sustainability position 10 years ago, it was brand new in that sector, and it blossomed. And so we're seeing that in cities and towns across Maine as well.
So what are you thinking about when you're thinking about the warming of the Gulf of Maine and how that might affect South Portland?
Sure. I think about the warming of the Gulf in terms of overall climate change. And that's one thing that we're seeing, and it certainly is going to have impacts on South Portland, on Portland, and on all the cities and towns around the bay. In terms of how it exacerbates how water enters the city, we're seeing more storm surges, where sea level rise, warmer oceans hold more water, and so it's helping with sea level rise, and that exacerbates storms that ordinarily without sea level rise wouldn't have caused as much damage around cities.
You're saying warmer oceans hold more water. My understanding, and correct me if this is wrong, that there are kind of two things going on. Because of the melting, there is more water in the ocean, but also warmer water expands, and it takes up more space.
Exactly. And Casco Bay really defines Portland and South Portland quite a bit. And people move to these cities for the quality of life that we have here. And what we're seeing is that that life is changing. The lobstermen are seeing it as they go out. Fishermen are seeing it. People are seeing it all over the place. And what we want to do is preserve the quality of life and make sure that we are mitigating our impact on greenhouse gas emissions, which is to say transitioning to renewable energy, using energy better, smarter. It's sort of like the three R's for recycling, reduce, reuse, recycle. You can do the same with energy and say conservation. Let's use only what we need. Let's use what we need efficiently, and let's transition to renewable energy is one way we're going about it. And then, of course, even with the mitigation that we're doing, we're seeing climate effects already. So how can we also adapt to the climate change that we are seeing and know is coming?
That's what I was going to ask. What kind of adaptations are you seeing, for example, changes in zoning as far as how things are built on the waterfront and even inland?
Yep, that's a great. So we are in the process of developing our climate action and adaptation plan called One Climate Future. And we're doing this in collaboration with Portland. And as far as we know, we are the only two cities in the whole country that are collaborating to do a climate action adaptation plan on a regional level. So that is really fantastic to begin with, because they're more than one city issue. It's a regional issue. This is also the first time that cities are doing a climate action and adaptation plan. We've really been focusing on mitigation. Now we're turning to adaptation as well. It will involve looking at zoning issues. It will involve looking at land use issues. And we haven't determined exactly what policies we will put in place, but rather we're looking at where our vulnerabilities are and how we will make sure that we are resilient in the path of storms that we know are coming.
And I know that you, Andy, you see this as part of not only one of the challenges, but one of the opportunities, one of the ways in which this area can be at the forefront.
So it's certainly part of the statistic around the warming is that we're seeing changes sooner and at a faster rate than many other places have seen them. And so we have to deal with it. We have to figure out how to adapt and be productive against this, these rapid changes in the ocean and on land. And so the solutions that we're developing here, we think that there's the potential for us to learn things and do things that could be really a national model. And, you know, I think the example of South Portland and Portland working together, that's a really, really great example of that.
All right. Megan, I want to ask you about ocean acidification. I know that this is something that threatens Maine's oyster farms. How is this related to warmer water?
So ocean acidification is somewhat independent of warming water, although they're often driven by similar factors. Ocean acidification in the open ocean is driven by increases in atmospheric CO2, which goes into the water and causes a lowering of the acidity, driving the pH down, making it more acidic. In coastal areas, the drivers are much more complex, including changes in the amount of productivity happening in an area. It can be driven by eutrophication, so the input of nutrients into a coastal area, and also changes in precipitation. And New England is projected to see an increase in precipitation in fall, winter, and spring months in coming years, with a decrease in precipitation in the summer months. So ocean acidification can affect shellfish by making it harder for them to form their shells. They require more energy to make their shells. This is particularly a challenge for larval shellfish, which have a finite amount of energy in the very first larval development stage. But for much of oyster aquaculture in Maine, that stage is happening within hatcheries, where we can control the conditions of the water that the larvae are growing in. So, for example, at Mooksee Farm in 2009, we started to have larval production problems. And this was before we really understood the implications of ocean acidification. And so it was quickly understood that these larval production problems were happening after heavy rainfall events. And then Bill Mook, the owner of Mooksee Farm, got in touch with West Coast Hatcheries, who were also having larval production problems, and also with Joe Salisbury from the University of New Hampshire. And they were able to determine that the problems were caused by this extra fresh water following these heavy rain events, and that fresh water was bringing a lower saturation state, more acidic water into the hatchery. Since then, we have always buffered the water that we use in the hatchery. That's kind of like taking a Tums to make the water a little bit more basic. And that has made our larval production more consistent than ever before. But we haven't yet seen problems with oyster growth on our lease site where we can't control conditions yet. That may be because the waters are warming and oysters grow faster in warmer waters. So at this point, the warming waters may be obscuring any effects of ocean acidification on the oyster growth.
So we have a lot of things going on here. The water's warming. There's more ocean acidification, but there's also more of these rainfall events where a whole lot of fresh water falls out of the sky into streams and rivers that are going into where the hatcheries are.
Yes.
Okay. We're going to go to a question before the break. We're going to go to Bruce in Harpswell. Hi, Bruce. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you, Jennifer. This question is probably for Andy. Andy, I'm going to ask about the Greenland meltwater from the ice sheet. This may be diverting the waters of the Gulf Stream and increasing the Canary Current, which then comes around and increases the hot Gulf Stream water. Does this play a part in the warming of the Gulf of Maine?
You answered the question. No, it's exactly what we're thinking about. So there are a number of factors that contribute to the warming that we've seen in the Gulf of Maine. But these large oceanographic changes that you were talking about, that's really the prime driver. It sort of sets the background state for the temperatures that we've experienced. So melting in places like Greenland and freshwater coming out of the Arctic gets into the North Atlantic. Freshwater is light, so it wants to sit on top of the saltier water in the Atlantic, and it alters the whole circulation pattern in the North Atlantic. And one of the side effects is that the Gulf of Maine gets warmer, the Barents Sea, the area north of Norway, also gets warmer, and then we have this area in the center of the Atlantic that's one of the few places in the world that's actually cooled over the last 15 or 20 years. And that's really clearly a signal of these big changes going on in the North Atlantic. And then you add on top of that, the Gulf of Maine is now sitting underneath a much warmer atmosphere. We're having warmer summers. That's a part of our warming story as well. And the big ocean heat wave years that we've had in 2012, 2016, and 2018, those were years where we had that really strong warm ocean condition that sort of set the stage, and then we hit it with really warm atmosphere for weeks at a time, and that sort of popped up to these really record temperatures.
Well, Bruce, thank you so much for your good question. I appreciate you calling into Maine Calling. If you'd like to ask a question, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send us a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet @MaineCalling or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Maine Masonic Charitable Foundation, supporting Maine Public Radio's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine. AARP Maine, working to lower prescription drug costs. Learn more at aarp.org/rx. And Maine Maritime Museum in Bath, offering Kennebec River cruises aboard the 1906 schooner Mary E. MaineMaritimeMuseum.org.
50 years after the Apollo 11 moon landing, the head of NASA has his sights on another giant leap for mankind.
Everybody who was alive when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walked on the moon, they know exactly where they were when that day happened. My generation does not have that memory.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. NASA's plan to put a human on Mars. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered weekday evenings from 4 to 6:30. The next stop on Maine Public News' Tell Me More tour is Millinocket. As Maine Public News travels the state to hear directly from you, learn what you feel are the most important issues in your community, and how Maine Public News can best serve you and keep you informed, the event takes place this coming Thursday, July 18th, at the North Light Gallery Annex at 256 Penobscot Avenue, starting at 2, immediately following a live Maine Calling on the Road with Jennifer Rooks, which starts at 1 p.m. sharp. For more information about the Tell Me More tour visits, including Thursday's Millinocket event, please visit mainepublic.org and click on Events or the banner ad.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Warming Waters in the Gulf of Maine. Joining me, Meredith White, who is head of research for MOOC Sea Farm, Andrew Pershing, chief scientific officer at the Gulf of Maine Research Institute, and Julie Rosenbach, Sustainability Director for the City of South Portland. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Joining me now on the line is Marissa McMahon. She is a fisheries scientist with Manomet, a science-driven nonprofit focused on sustainability. Thanks for calling in, Marissa.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
What are some of the projects Manomet is working on to address the effects of warming in our region's fisheries?
So we really kind of have two branches of what our fisheries work focuses on. The first is in restoring ecosystem productivity. So, for example, restoring populations of river-run fish like alewives. The real drive there is that if we can restore some of these native populations, our ecosystem will ultimately be more resilient to climate change. And then the second sort of branch, which is where I spend most of my time, is in diversifying fisheries opportunities. As the folks on the program have already done a great job of pointing out, we are in this very precarious situation where we have this rapidly warming water, and also in Maine in particular, an incredibly high dependence on just one species in our fisheries system. So, we're 75% dependent on the American lobster. So that really puts us in a precarious position. And so a lot of what we're trying to do is to find new opportunities for fishermen to make a living on the water.
I understand this is Green Crab Week, and restaurants in New England are serving green crab dishes here. So funny, just a couple years ago, Sam Hayward was on the program talking about trying to cook green crabs with chef friends, and it was sort of so new and different, and now we have Green Crab Week. Has there been a concerted effort to see them as viable, as a real fishery?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so that's one of the things at Manomet that we've been working on for diversifying fisheries is trying to make use of an invasive pest. And so we've been doing this work for probably 3 or 4 years now. Other organizations have also been working on developing fisheries and culinary uses for green crabs. The New Hampshire Sea Grant, the University of Maine, an organization called Green Crab R&D down in Massachusetts. It's just in the last 3 years, it's amazing how much time and effort has gone into this and also how much progress we've made. I mean, it's not uncommon now that you can go into a restaurant in Mid-Coast Maine and find a dish that's made with green crabs or features green crab in it. So we're really excited about that.
Is the goal to create a fishery or to get rid of all the green crabs?
So predominantly to create a new source of economic opportunity for fishermen, to really just take this pest and try to benefit from it in some way. If we can encourage enough people to fish for green crabs, and remove enough of them out of the water, then, maybe we will someday see that there is an ecosystem impact, a positive ecosystem impact as well. But right now, the focus and the drive is really just to create this new fisheries resource, a new source of economic opportunity for fishermen.
Well, Marissa, thanks so much for calling in. That's Marissa McMahon, a fisheries scientist with Manomet. We're going to move on now to Catherine Allen, an assistant professor at the University of Maine's School of Earth and Climate Sciences. Thanks for calling in, Catherine.
Thanks for having me.
I understand you were recently selected for a National Science Foundation Award. Congratulations. Tell us about the research you're doing.
Well, with this award, we are investigating the long-term history of the Gulf of Maine and the surrounding region. And when I say long-term, that's several thousand years of ocean history that we're aiming to understand. And the motivation for the work, in part, is the recent warming that has been observed, that what Andy Pershing was just discussing in the last 30 years, having context for those kinds of changes is very helpful from a climate dynamics point of view.
So what are you learning?
Well, we're just starting the project. We just got funded. But the approach is to take ancient fossil material that accumulates out in marine sediments. They're organisms that build tiny shells that build up there for thousands of years. And we collect these sediment cores and then extract the fossils and analyze their composition. And from that composition, we can actually learn a lot about the past ocean. We can start to reconstruct past ocean temperature, salinity, and other properties as well. And our focus in this study is on understanding the long-term temperature trends and variability in the Gulf of Maine and the Scotian Shelf and Slope region.
What are you hoping that scientists and planners will be able to do with the information that you learn?
Well, I'm hoping that we'll get more insight into what makes the Gulf of Maine so sensitive to broader regional and global changes, and maybe gain a little bit of insight into the actual mechanisms of warming. We're having some clues from modern observations, but in some cases we're limited by the relatively short length of some of these observational records. So what we're hoping is that we can start to get a little more insight into the broader, how the Gulf of Maine fits into the greater North Atlantic and global ocean and atmospheric circulation patterns, so that ultimately I would love to improve our abilities for ocean forecasting, but it's a ways off. We're still just trying to understand what the history is at the moment.
All right. Well, thanks so much for calling in. That's Catherine Hall. She's an assistant professor at UMaine's School of Earth and Climate Sciences. We'll start with an email from Nancy. She writes, "Recently I heard Rob Snyder of Island Institute talk on this very subject. One question based on what he said. Black sea bass is probably going to become a prominent commercial species in the Gulf of Maine. But the fishing permits are all in the mid-Atlantic. How can we get those permits for our local fishermen?" I'm not sure this is a question for you all. Do you know, Andy?
Yeah, so and interesting, this is actually some work that Marissa McMahon did her PhD thesis on. Really interesting, looking at this new species, black sea bass, that's moving into this region. And the challenge with black sea bass, like a lot of other fish, is that access to the fish, especially on a commercial basis, is awarded on a state-by-state basis, and that's based on your history of the state participating in that fishery. And so what that tends to do is it locks in states that have traditionally caught particular species, giving them the rights to those species, and states like Maine, in this case, that have never really caught black sea bass commercially, have a really hard time getting that access. And this is something that, you know, we're going to see coming up over and over as we deal with climate change, is that any decision where you're basing it on historical conditions, history is no longer a reliable guide. And so those are the sorts of decisions that are really going to be challenged as the planet warms up.
That reminds me, Meredith, of something I read that you wrote, that there isn't even a new normal. Things are changing so fast that there isn't even a normal anymore.
That is true. We are seeing changes all the time. For example, we talked about increased precipitation, which causes closures in our shellfish growing areas, which can have large devastating effects to small aquaculture businesses when we can't harvest shellfish during these closures. Things are constantly changing.
We'll go to Charlotte, who's calling from Somerville. Hi, Charlotte. Go ahead.
Hi. I was wondering if Maine and hopefully other states passed a law that all shell remains from clams, oysters, mussels, everything, had to be collected and dumped back into the ocean to help with acidification.
At this point, I do not believe it is a statewide mandate that shell recycling programs happen, but one of the recommendations of the 2015 Maine Ocean Acidification Commission report was to establish pilot scale studies of shell recycling programs, and I know that Maine Coastal Program has initiated at least one pilot scale study on shell recycling.
All right, Charlotte, thanks. We'll go to Jean, who's calling from New Sharon. Hi, Jean. Go ahead.
Hi. My question, maybe for Andrew, has to do with how the seasonal flow of spring freshet waters enriched with dissolved silica and oxygen and other nutrients has been affected by impounding water in the eastern Canadian region, and this has been felt to impact the Gulf of Maine. What do you know about that?
So that's a really interesting a hypothesis that people have put out that putting dams, especially big dams in the north, is going to hold a whole bunch of sediment and reduce the supply of some of the important minerals that go into the ocean, and that that could affect productivity in other places in the ocean. We actually did some calculations in this, and I think most oceanographers would agree with this, is that just the scale of the scales are just really off, and that the ocean is so much bigger, and there's so much silica and other materials in the ocean that, you know, even really large dam projects are not going to have a major effect once you get very far away from those projects. So there really is no way that dams in the in Quebec and going into the Gulf of St. Lawrence, there really is no way that those could have an effect on the Gulf of Maine. The math just really doesn't work out.
Gene, thank you for your question. And if you would like to ask a question, our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. A tweet from Leslie here. She writes, "My dad was talking about this in the 1970s. He told me once that in the 21st century there would be no lobsters left in Maine waters. Seems he was right." Wadsworth Owen, oceanographer, 1932 to 2009. Let's see, and we'll go to an email from Becky. "My husband is a lobster fisherman up here in West Bay and off Scudic. When he brings home a hard-shell lobster for us to eat, I have found the shell to be much harder and the meat much tougher. I now have to use a hammer to crack the claws where in the past a simple cracker worked fine. I am not alone in this observation. Is this because of warming water and carbon sequestration?"
Interesting hypothesis. I haven't heard that one before. I've heard more people, including a lot of the dealers around here, talking about having a hard time finding hard shell lobsters, that during the warm water, especially during some of the warm years we've had, that they see lobsters essentially molting continuously throughout the year. And so they have a lot more soft shell lobster that are coming in throughout the year and not just in the summer months like it used to be.
You know, we're talking generally about the Gulf of Maine, and Julie's talking about Casco Bay. If we look at the Maine coast, is the temperature rise consistent even along the Maine coast, or are parts of Maine warming more quickly within the Gulf of Maine?
If you look across the Gulf of Maine, especially if you're looking at, you know, several years together, right, 3 or 4 years together, it really is the Gulf of Maine kind of moving up together. And it isn't just the Gulf of Maine. It's the Gulf of Maine. It's also the waters south in southern New England, Georges Bank, and the Scotian Shelf as well. All of these waters are warming up together. But at any given time, you can see some differences. So right now in the Gulf of Maine, it's really, really warm in the western Gulf of Maine and Massachusetts Bay, basically from kind of, southern Maine south. But there are some parts down east and in the eastern part of the Gulf of Maine that are actually running a little colder than average right now.
Okay. We'll go to Nemo calling from Steuben. Hi, Nemo. Go ahead.
Hi. I was wondering if we're going to be looking forward to a pearl industry now that the oysters are coming up here.
A good question for Meredith. Go ahead.
That's a great question. Any bivalve has the potential to make a pearl inside of it, but the American oyster, the species that is cultured here in Maine, is not known for its pearls. Pearl oysters are generally grown in the Pacific Ocean with a different species of oysters.
Nemo, thanks for your question. Let me ask you this, though, Meredith. I mean, I know that Maine oyster farmers will say that Maine's oysters are the best in the world. Does the flavor change with the warming water?
Oh, there are many factors that contribute to the flavor, including salinity and the location that the oysters are grown, the salinity of the waters there, and the food that is available to the oysters. So that's the phytoplankton that are in the ocean waters where the oysters are grown. And certainly warming waters will have an influence on the species abundance and composition of the phytoplankton, and that could have an effect on the taste of the oysters.
All right. Well, we are going to take another quick break. If you'd like to join the conversation, we'd love to have your call, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainpublic.org, post on our Facebook page, or tweet at Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do New England Forestry Foundation, celebrating 75 years of conserving forests for future generations. Learn more at newenglandforestry.org. And Dead River Company, celebrating 110 years, delivering propane and heating oil to fellow Mainers, deadriver.com.
InSource Renewables is a solar cooperative of workers here based in Pittsfield, Maine. We're involved in the construction of solar energy systems for residences, commercial businesses, and municipalities. Our clients come from all over the state of Maine. They come from a variety of backgrounds, political leanings, age groups. Maine Public is great for that in terms of the breadth of audience that it has in all of those various demographics, as well as the geographic reach. We underwrite on Maine Public because we see Maine Public as a critical asset to the people of Maine. At a time when things are very polarized and we need information that we can trust, that's what Maine Public brings to the table. So, you know, as much as we underwrite with Maine Public to help establish a relationship and familiarity with our brand, we really see it as helping support an institution in the state of Maine that's critical to our future as both Mainers and as well as a Maine business trying to do well by our communities.
And join us at 2 o'clock following Maine Calling for a BBC documentary on vaccination. Vaccination considered one of the 20th century's biggest public health successes, but in Western Europe, Japan, Kenya, and Indonesia, concerns about vaccines have resulted in outbreaks of disease. The evidence debates new research which reveals global attitudes to vaccination. That's a BBC documentary, The Evidence, coming up at 2 on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Warming in the Gulf of Maine. Joining me, Andy Pershing with the Gulf of Maine Research Institute, Julie Rosenbach with the City of South Portland, and Meredith White with Mook Sea Farm. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. We have an email from Peter. Could you ask Julie and your other guest what citizen action can be taken to mitigate U.S. carbon output? As a way to protect our oceans and overall climate, Mainers, I heard, Cape Elizabeth recently joined 8 other Maine cities in endorsing a national carbon fee and dividend bill, with South Portland and other municipalities be endorsing.
Well, that's a really good question. There's a lot that people can do in terms of mitigating climate action. In our climate action and adaptation plan, we're looking at energy used in buildings, energy used in transportation, waste reduction, and of course, adaptation and making our cities more resilient. I should back up and say that President Trump removed the U.S. from the Paris Climate Agreement, where 195 countries around the world got together and agreed that in order to avert the worst impacts of climate change, such as increased ocean acidification, we need to keep warming to 2 degrees Celsius. And so each country has national goals to follow. As soon as the U.S. Was pulled out of the Paris Accords, cities across the United States directly made a commitment to honor these commitments. So now you have cities and towns across the states developing climate action and adaptation plans, saying we are going to move forward and we are going to address energy and we are going to make sure that our contribution minimizes the effects of climate change. South Portland and Portland, as I said, got together and we're developing one climate future. We're in the process of it. It should come out in December 2020. And we're looking at building energy. I mentioned conservation, efficiency, and renewable energy. South Portland has built one of the largest municipal solar arrays in the state of Maine. We partnered with Portland on that. And many other communities around Maine are looking at our example. Now, South Portland is in a unique position because we are a city of 25,000 people. We're a really small city. but we're the fourth largest city in Maine. So I like to say we're a small but mighty city that's doing a lot of things. We're looking at what New York City is doing, Boston, a lot of the big cities, and saying, how do we take these policies that move us forward and mitigate climate change and make them work in our community? And I think we're doing a good job so far. The other conversations that we're having with communities is, well, what can't we do at a city level that we need to do at a state level? And so recently we said, okay, well, solar policy has been really difficult in Maine over the last 8 years. It's been approved in both houses, vetoed, and then lost on a very narrow majority. How do we advocate for solar policy that will work for municipalities and will work for our residents? And we recently, the legislature passed a fantastic solar bill, and that's going to be a game changer in terms of people being able to adopt solar policy and move forward with solar policy. You can transform your life. You can put solar panels on your house, and it's not as expensive as you think. Oftentimes, the initial first cost is a large investment, but you can get an efficiency main loan to do that. You can buy an electric vehicle and place a charger on your house that is powered by solar energy and drive to work on your electric vehicle. You can use heat pumps. Heating is one of the biggest contributions to climate change. We heat with oil, we heat with natural gas, we heat with propane, and there are not a lot of drop-in replacements for these. Geothermal is quite expensive, but a lot of people in Maine are now looking to air source heat pumps. And the benefit of these is that they're really, really efficient, and they provide cooling that Maine is starting to need as we're having warmer, more humid summers. And so there's a lot of things, and those are also very cost effective and have a quick payback. So there are a lot of things people can explore in their lives. And in the city level, we're working on how do we make these things easier? How do we remove the barriers for people purchasing this? Of course, we have to look at transportation on a wide scale and incentive programs, land policy programs as well.
All right, we're going to go to Peter, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Peter, go ahead.
Yes. Thank you, Julie, for that summary of things that municipalities and we personally can do and the state of Maine can do as well. But isn't a constantly rising price on carbon emissions at the federal level the real missing piece for effectively trying to stabilize the climate and the ecosystems of Casco Bay?
Yes, I think that the dividend program is a great program. I have not run that through my city council yet, but I know that other Maine towns have signed on to that program. We're in the process of looking at, on a city level, what can we do? I think that some type of price incentive on carbon is ultimately going to be necessary. The form that that takes, I'm not sure. There's a carbon tax, there's a dividend, there's a cap and trade system. We have REGI, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Emissions Initiative, that has worked quite well. I completely agree with you, and that's something that we simply haven't gotten to yet, being busy with our climate action and adaptation plan.
Peter, thanks for your call. We'll move to North Haven and Becky. Hi, Becky, go ahead.
Hi, I'm going back to the Gulf of Maine, and I just wanted to ask a question. I mean, it's all connected, and I really appreciate what Julie has said, but I wanted to just ask a question. I know a couple of years ago, there were very few phytoplankton in the Gulf of Maine at all, and I think it was one of the years that we really had a tremendous amount of increase in water temperature. But I'm just wondering what you're seeing in terms of phytoplankton. A theory is that some of the phytoplankton that we would have been seeing have been lost due to the numbers of dams that are mega dams that have been installed in Canada, therefore reducing the amount of diatoms, et cetera, that come into the St. Lawrence and down through the Scotian Current to us. Just asking that question. Thanks.
Yeah, so as we discussed earlier, the hypothesis about the dams just really doesn't add up. I think any oceanographer who studied the Gulf of Maine is going to tell you that the amount of water coming out of the Gulf of St. Lawrence, even the whole Gulf of St. Lawrence system, is not going to be a significant contributor relative to the ocean water that comes into the Gulf of Maine at any given time. As far as the phytoplankton cycles, there was a recent paper that that Nick Record at the Bigelow Lab led that talked about really interesting changes in the phenology and the timing of when we're seeing phytoplankton blooms. And the Gulf of Maine has characteristically had a really strong and really intense bloom of phytoplankton in the spring and then kind of a smaller one in the fall. And what we're seeing is that the phytoplankton is sort of leveling off throughout the year. And in fact, we're actually seeing higher levels of phytoplankton in the winter, but then a lower spring bloom. And so that's having effect on things like some of the other plankton species that consume the phytoplankton. And that's propagating all the way up to animals like right whales.
Becky, thanks for your call. Did you have anything to add to that, Meredith?
Well, we have noticed a decline in the spring phytoplankton bloom in the water that we're pumping into our hatchery as well. So it's something that we can notice at the local scale, too.
Okay. Thank you, Becky. We're going to move to Heidi, who's calling from Southern Maine. Hi, Heidi. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm a proud graduate from Deer Isle Stonington High School, class of 1984. And I would like to know what's going on with the fisheries up there. We seem to pay a lot of attention down here in Southern Maine, but I'd like to know about what's happening up there, and all, especially since they had their Fisherman's Day celebration yesterday. And but I'd also like to point out that we're not really hitting our mark, even when the Paris Climate Accord set up their regulations. It should have been more stringent, because right now we're over the 350 mark of what's safe. We're over 400 now. Somebody might be able to explain more eloquently what that is to people, but it's what's founded the 350.org and the 350 Maine type groups that have been active since the tar sands fight in South Portland. And I don't like using the word fight, but anyway, if you could point some of those out, I'd really appreciate it.
Okay, Julie, go ahead.
Sure. Well, I can speak to the being over 400 parts per million. So the Paris Climate Accord, breaking it down, if we are to keep warming to 2 degrees or ideally to 1.5 degrees warming, then what we have determined is that we need to cut our greenhouse gas emissions 80% by 2050. And that's our climate action adaptation plan goal. It's between 80% and 100%. And I should point out that even if we do cut our emissions down that significantly, we are still going to see some of the effects of climate change as we try to catch up. But that's the goal that's been translated. And so a lot of cities, when they adopt climate action and adaptation plans, it's 80% by 2050 is the goal.
Okay. And about the fisheries further down east in southern Maine.
So,
Andy?
It's right. It's comparing the fisheries now in down east Maine versus when the caller was there in high school, I think the big difference would be that the fishery now is really dominated by lobster. It's a little bit of scallops and some other things, but lobster's the big driver of that economy down there. Where in the 80s, it would have been a much more diverse fishery. They would have had cod and haddock and, groundfish and many of those species that have been overfished. And so now cod in particular was overfished, and now we're hitting it with a warmer ocean, and so it's even harder to get that population to rebuild. But there's some work that my colleagues at the Gulf of Maine Research Institute are doing around modeling and projecting some of the distribution changes of some of these mid-Atlantic species that are coming into the Gulf of Maine. And so we'll see probably in, 10, 20 years that there may be some new opportunities in places down east as some of these more mid-Atlantic species start to become a little more established.
Heidi, thanks so much for your call. We just have a couple minutes left, and I want to ask each of you, what's coming next? Do we know? I mean, you, Meredith, mentioned that there's no new normal now. Is the place you work, is Mook Sea Farm saying, we expect that 5 years from now this will be happening, therefore we're going to do this differently?
Yes, Mook Sea Farm is making great investments into the resiliency of the company as the environmental conditions change. We've just invested in a new land-based holding facility where we can isolate oysters from the rivers of our lease site. where we can hold them during a growing area closure and still be able to harvest from our land-based facility. And we will be exploring many other options for resiliency for our company.
Okay. And what about in South Portland, Julie, I'm wondering about tangible things that the city is doing because you see that in 5 years, X may be happening, or in 10 years, Y may be happening.
Well, we're just starting to plan for zoning changes, changes to our housing stock, how we might look at those and deal with those. So the adaptation piece is just in the beginning phase. We know that what we're going to have to plan for is more water and more water coming through. It can either come through or we can try to block it, but we're going to need to plan for more water. So that's one thing. The next thing that I'd say we are looking at is an energy transformation in our energy systems.
All right. And Andy, your last predictions for the next 5 or 10 years, are we going to still see the same rate, 0.11 degrees per year, or are you expecting something different?
I think that we're more likely going to kind of level off, I think, for a little while and stay at the warmer temperatures. But over the long term, we expect that the Gulf of Maine is going to continue to warm. We expect it's going to continue to warm at an above average rate relative to other places in the ocean. And I think the real challenge that we all have to face, and the Gulf of Maine is a great place to try to think about these problems, is that adaptation, you don't just adapt once. We're going to have to keep on adapting. And so we're really going to have to, instead of looking to the past, we're going to have to really be looking to the future and trying to anticipate changes.
All right. Well, thank you all for being here today. The voice you just heard, Andrew Pershing, Chief Scientific Officer at the Gulf of Maine Research Institute. Also here with me in the studio, Meredith White, Director of Research for MOOC Sea Farm, and Julie Rosenbach, Sustainability Director with the City of South Portland. Today's show was part of Maine Calling's continuing focus on the effects of climate change on our region. John Keimel ran the board today. Ella Boyd took your calls. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as helpful links and resources at mainecalling.org. Today's program will be broadcast again tonight at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. A quick note about this Thursday's program, Maine Calling will be live from Millinocket at the North Light Gallery. We'll talk about Katahdin Woods and Waters National Monument and how things are going there. Right after the show will be a Maine Public Tell Me More community discussion. It is free to attend. That's Thursday at 1 at the North Light Gallery in Millinocket. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.